Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world. To the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Welcome to Topically Yours on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. I'm your host, Deirdre Schuler, and as you may have guessed by the opening music, our guest today spent some time in law enforcement. Matthew Fogg is the first African-American that brought a lawsuit against the Department of Justice and won. Mr. Fogg was an outstanding member of the force with a record reflecting his achievements and direct involvement in major law enforcement trials, fugitive arrests, and operations, such as the Cuban refugee boat flotilla, the Atlanta Penitentiary Riot, the L.A. Riots, and Ruby Ridge. Mr. Fogg is a recipient of numerous recommendations and awards from the U.S. Justice Department. His community service awards include the U.S. President Points of Life Award and the Nike Corporation's For Midnight Basketball Tournament Award. And also an outstanding contribution to narcotics enforcement by a tactical officer or investigator nomination. Despite these accommodations and awards, U.S. Deputy Marshal Fogg witnessed discrimination within the ranks by white officers who claimed to be joking when they frequently used the N-word or dressed in white sheets or talked about wanting to kill black leaders. Also, black officers were often passed over for promotion. Well, we have Mr. Fogg with us today to tell us about his lawsuit, which only served to put him at risk for further discrimination for daring to pierce the blue wall of silence. Good evening, Mr. Fogg.
Good evening. Good to be on your show.
Thank you for coming. So just please feel free to correct me if I'm not put forth your accomplishments and situation accurately. I understand you are. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. You were asking a question.
Mm-hmm. I understand you are a lifelong Washington, D.C. resident. And so can you tell me about your family and your background?
Well, again, I was born here in Washington, D.C. I came up during the Civil Rights Movement, so I had an opportunity to understand a little bit of the racial tensions in America and how that affected me. Grew up in a big family, 10 of us. I'm an identical twin who was a Maryland State Trooper, Mark, and then also had a brother who was a correctional officer, so we had three of us in law enforcement. Two brothers served in Vietnam, three were in the military. My dad lived to be 100 years old. Four sisters. And pretty much we grew up in a Pentecostal setting here in Southeast Washington on Capitol Hill. So,
which one of your brothers got a Purple Heart?
My brother Joe Fogg got the Purple Heart. Actually, both of them did. Julius did as well. Both of them got wounded while in Vietnam. One was in the Navy and one was in the Army. we pretty much you know, like I said, growing up here, and then I ended up going to graduating out of high school in Washington, D.C., and I went to college in West Virginia called Marshall University. I got there right after the airplane crash. They made a movie, We Are Marshall. So I got to Marshall a year right after the airplane crash when they were pretty much around the setting of the movie when they were recruiting and trying to rebuild the university basketball football team. Then I graduated from Marshall and then ended up getting my degree in criminal justice administration. And but going back a little bit, I had a run-in with law enforcement when I was a young kid that I think really had an indelible effect on me about a false arrest, just where, you know, again, the police back in those days, they would just round up young black men and they'd arrest you and pretty much interrogate you and force you into confessions and all that type of stuff. And I was a young kid, 17, just turned 18. I assisted the manager of the store where I was working. We, some little young kid who was working around the store at the same time, he got robbed. He was about 14 or so, 13 or 14 years old, by some kids around his age. But we had seen these boys come around the store. And so when the police came, I said, look, I'm willing to, if I see these kids again, I know pretty much the ones that, you know, participate in this type of stuff. So the officer took down my name and another guy at the store's name as co-witnesses. And then somehow when the names went in to the queue and went downtown to detectives, they got our names mixed up as the suspects. Came and locked us up. Took us through a whole bunch of changes for 2 days. And just really just, it was an experience that you just couldn't begin to describe. Everything
it's
we went through.
It's a type of experience that stays with you for life. And you were saying back then, but it's still happening now. There's nothing's changed.
Oh, it's happening now. Of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen it. But I'm just saying, I think it had the effect on me. Instead of running me away from law enforcement, it really made me want to understand it more. And then when I got to college, I was in engineering, but that got a little bit to be a little too difficult for me. So I ended up switching over to criminal justice administration. That was my minor. Got my degree, and then I came out and ultimately got with the U.S. Marshals. That experience caused me to, again, have a more, I guess you might say, an understanding of law enforcement, a sense of knowing how mistakes can be made and
so
how.
What is the criteria to become a U.S. Marshal? Do they have a hard standard?
Well, currently, I mean, they're federal law enforcement agency, just like the alcohol, tobacco, firearms, the FBI, and all the rest. The Marshal Service does not, only difference is we don't require a degree, 4-year degree. You know, they require experience, law enforcement experience, of course. With a degree, it's more palatable to get in if you have a degree. But, you know, experience and pretty much a clean record. And pretty much the requirements are clean, you know, have a clear record, good references, and, you know, a good background, a solid background, and then as well as, you know, the education mixed along with the training, with your knowledge and experiences. That's
pretty much the situation that happened to you as a child. That was all expunged?
Yes, that was expunged. That was cleared up. But the whole problem, but again, and it's part of, you know, I'm writing a book and it's part of my story. It talks about, you know, this. Because, you know, my whole story as we get into it about the race thing and how I got connected, even when I went to college, I think having, because the man that locked me up was a white guy, and I always remember the way he treated me and the way he talked to me, and I didn't quite look at race at that time as the issue, but then later as I began to see the numbers of African-Americans in my community and how African-Americans were treated and the biasness within the criminal justice system and begin to see it firsthand, then I begin to put two and two together. And pretty much the system came down to, hey, make an arrest at all costs, and so you go after the weakest link. The weakest link happened to be people of color, people who can't defend themselves. And you can get your numbers up on those folks, and whatever you say they did it. You know, I mean, you know, we're getting further into it. But that's kind of like once I got into law enforcement.
So it becomes a numbers game?
Oh, big time, big time. And once I see, once I came out of college and joined the bar service, I began to see not only race, I began to see race was an issue internally, how discriminatory, how race was a part of how who got promoted, who got the best assignments, who got terminated, fired for charges and so forth. You begin to see race played an important role there. And once you saw that, then you realize, hey, if I'm wearing a badge and a gun and I'm just like my colleagues and racism exists within the institution itself, imagine what these same bigoted cops are going to do to people on the street. I mean, you know, if they're going to, they're going to exert their homophobic, their biased opinions against me, and I'm working with them, you know what they're going to do to the people of color on the street, and that's what I began to see and notice. So I became a vanguard. I started taking up and standing up to it, and a lot of people didn't want me to. They, matter of fact, people saw me as one of the U.S. Marshals that was most likely to succeed. I mean, they liked me. I mean, they liked my way, my demeanor. I was articulate. I had a degree. I was black. I fit the part. I was tall. I had the voice, step away from the vehicle. Everything that, you know, people would say, hey, this is a guy who fits the mold of being the head marshal. And so don't do anything, man, to rock any boat. Don't go against the system. Even though you see things that aren't right, things that are wrong, you can't fix it all, man. You know, it'll change in time. What we want you to do is just go along and get along, because we like for one day to see you become the head U.S. Marshal. You know, that's
sort of who's telling you this? Other black officers or white officers?
Yeah, other black and white officers. I mean, people who liked you, people, you know, managers, people who were around you, people who saw that I was a guy that might would look out for the little guy and step into stuff, or might be willing to complain about something if I saw I wasn't right. They were just wanting to tell me, look, man, you know what happens when you blow that whistle. You know what happens to me. No matter how much we want to say it doesn't exist, we know what happens behind that blue wall of silence. That's why you call it the blue wall of silence. Because you learn real fast, keep your mouth shut, huh?
What happens if you dare to? What happens if you dare to defy the blue wall of silence?
Well, if you go against the blue wall of silence, I mean, it's retribution. I mean, it's like in the military, anything else. You know, when you're in a law enforcement environment, you in what I call a command and control environment. That's where, you know, when you're in a command and control environment, you pretty much go along. Even if you guys are all marching up the wrong side of the street, and we all know we're marching up the wrong side of the street, who's going to be the one to say, hey, why are we marching up the wrong side of the street? You just march up the wrong side of the street. Okay? And so what happens is you learn in those types of environments, because you really need that. You have to depend on people. That's why they call them command and control, because if you're in a firefight or some type of fight where your life is in danger, you need people. You got to have command and control. When you tell somebody, go over there and do this or do that, you can't have them question. People have to do what they're told to do. So it's very easy in command and control environments
Ruby Ridge was such a disaster?
Yes. I mean, yes. I mean, and besides poor planning and, you know, going into a situation that we knew had a lot of problems from the very beginning, and there was a lot of
attenuating circumstances,
debating about it before we even went into it, huh?
It seemed like there was a lot of extenuating circumstances. Basically, it was just initially it started off as an argument between two neighbors, correct? And one
That's
reported
correct.
The other.
That's right.
One got mad and reported the other.
Yeah, but there were actual warrants out there. I mean, see, you know, long before, what I tell people is, you know, if you watch the movie Fugitive, right, And you remember the old story, you know, Tommy Lee Jones, the fugitive, and, you know, this doctor who was supposed to was found guilty, but really he didn't commit the crime. And then you remember the bus somehow was a crash, and the doctor ended up getting away. And then, of course, the fugitives, the U.S. Marshals, we're the ones who are, you know, responsible for tracking down escaped federal prisoners. And the point I'm getting to is the doctor really did not commit the crime. But as a U.S. Marshal, when you got a warrant or you got a document that's coming out of a court, because that's what our job is, our job to enforce the process and enforce the laws that the judicial processes that come out of the judicial, federal judicial system. So when we get a warrant and the judge issues a warrant on somebody or whatever, we got to go get them. It's not our job to determine whether or not you committed the crime. Our job is to go and lock you up. So I'm saying that in the sense of Ruby Ridge was there were actual warrants outstanding on the Weaver, on the family, on the people, on Randy Weaver and them. There were warrants there. It was just Weaver and them was not going to turn themselves in. And so once they decided they weren't going to turn themselves in, then there was alcohol, tobacco, and firearms that tried to make their arrest. They couldn't, so they asked us in our special operations unit if we could do it, and we decided to do it over a debate. There were some people in our agency that didn't want to do it because it felt like that hill and that scenario would present too many problems for us to go up there and try to take these guys out. But then there was a section of our organization that said, hey, we can do it, and we'll do it. And they went up there and attempted it. And then that's when things, you know, turned
Well, the son
bad.
Got shot in the back and the wife got shot in the head.
That's right, and the marshal got killed. My supervisor got killed, Bill Deegan, and the dog got killed, and it was just a mess. But I mean,
it was a mess, and they had never done anything really. Everybody just got paranoid.
See, there's a lot more to the story than how it ultimately ended up happening that created that scenario. But what I guess my point that I'm making is, you know. Because I've been on scenarios where, you know, things go south on you. And to God be the glory, you know, I ain't been killed. I mean, I've been in some pretty hectic scenarios. Now, I wasn't actually at the Ruby Ridge location. My team, the SWAT team that I remember went up there. But I was actually sent to the FBI command center right when Bill Deegan, the marshal, was killed. And then I was in Washington, the FBI command center, monitoring a lot of stuff, everything that was happening from that point on. But the point that we're making here, going back to my earlier story about how race and how I got involved, begin to look at this whole picture of how law enforcement does things and how when you add that ingredient, racial bias in law enforcement, I mean, if you go back, there's a book out there called 100 Years of Lynching. If you ever read that, you'll find that out of most of the lynchings that occurred, most of them occurred under the auspices of law enforcement. They lock you up, put you in there, and then somehow wind up letting the bad guys get to your clan or even they're part of the clan themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing today.
Well, they were saying a lot of them were under the sheets too.
Yes, exactly. And today what we have, we still have a lot of this racial tension in America that's still pretty much pervasive, and especially in law enforcement. I hate to say that because I was in law enforcement. I watched it. And the war on drugs is a prime example of that. When we look at the numbers of African Americans that have been affected by this war on drugs and how biased it was, and the fact that I was assigned to the Drug Enforcement Administration as a special agent in charge, so I was cross-designated. I was a U.S. Marshal, but I was also assigned to DEA at one point, running a DEA task force. I had DEA agents under me, subordinate to me. I had local PD and all, and we were running there. My group was the one who arrested Brian Tribble, the guy who gave Lynn Bias the cocaine that caused his death. Lynn Bias being, you know, remember that the Boston Celtics, you know, basketball player. My team was the one who arrested Brian Tribble, the guy who gave him the drug. And that was when the whole drug war was really beginning to ratchet up. And they began to dump all of this money into this so-called war on drugs. Now, the problem I had with it was, if it had have been a what we call an equal opportunity enforcement operation, I say this all the time, if we did all of our enforcement operations equally, I'd been fine because my thought was, okay, if you do the drugs, you're going to do the time. You do the crime, you do the time. But what I began to see early on, real quick, was that it wasn't that way. It was, let's go after the weakest link. Let's go after people who are easy targets. Let's make this thing look like we're warring on drugs, but really all we're doing, we're not putting a dent in anything, and all we're doing is it turned out to be what I call ethnic cleansing.
One thing is the people, the guys in the street, by the time it gets to the street, it's nobody's going after the people that bring it in, fly it in.
Right.
Because those are the guys that are bringing the drugs in.
Right. I mean, there's some resemblance of our operations. I mean, certainly we're watching the borders and everything, but you just can't put enough people to stop this drugs from coming in the country. And then at one point in time, that whole thing of what was happening in L.A. with Ollie North and that whole thing about how they was bringing drugs into South South L.A., into those areas, and actually bringing drugs, making sure these drugs got into these urban areas so that they could then turn around and go after these folks and lock them up. So it's a lot going on. It's a book out called Dope Inc. You got to read that. There's a lot of information out there that talks about how this war on drugs was a failure from the very beginning. I compare them a lot to what we call alcohol prohibition. At some point, the problem was with alcohol prohibition, they got America got the message real quick and learned real fast in a short period of time, within about a 10-year period, not even that long, in a short period of time, that alcohol prohibition doesn't work. And so what they did, they ended it, and they started regulating. Now, we know alcohol is probably one of the worst drugs you could have out there. But the bottom line was, because it was affecting non-people of color, white and Italians and people, they decided that, look, we're not going to go out here and keep putting these folks in prison and locking them up and jailing these folks. So let's just go ahead and regulate this. Because once they regulate it, they take out the what we call the black market, and they take out the danger aspect, the sense of the violent side of it. Because that's really what makes a drug, makes this war on drugs so hideous, is you've got all of this violence associated with the black market aspect of it. And that's what alcohol prohibition did. So the minute they regulated alcohol, it went away. We're saying, that's why I'm with an organization called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We're lawyers, we're judges, we're cops from all over the country, people in the legal field. And we're all saying, thousands of us, and we're all saying that the war on drugs is a failure. It's not working. But even more so, it is the second slavery. It has put more people of color and more African Americans in prison than anything since slavery. It has
there are more black people in prison than there were slaves.
That's right. Today, when you talk about people that are on parole, people that are incarcerated, people that have a felony record, when you add all of those up, you're more African-Americans in the system today than there were slaves at the time of the Civil War. That's correct.
And isn't it interesting, though, that if you're a criminal, you can't vote, so they effectively take your vote away from you, too.
That's exactly right. And that's what I was getting to when I was saying if it was an equal opportunity enforcement operation. And when it really became real to me, when it became real, was we were setting up these dragnet operations. And let me know when you want to take a break, because I'm looking at the time here, and I'm not sure how you run the show. But we were setting up these dragnet. We were setting up these dragnet operations, and dragnet meaning U.S. Marshals. We would do what we call these 3-month, 90-day dragnets, where we go in, we get with state and local law enforcement in, like, say, 7 cities, Chicago, L.A., New York, Baltimore, Miami, Washington, D.C., and we Philadelphia, and we go, okay, look, we contact the state, all the local police, the sheriffs, those areas. We get U.S. Marshals. Now, U.S. Marshals, we would spearhead the operation. But what we would do is for 90 days, We'd go into these areas and we would lock up every warrants and help the locals go out to their warrants. We'd go out to our warrants, drug dealers, DEA warrants, all the people that are conspiracy cases. And we just go out to folks and guns and drug and gun and we try to confiscate as much drugs, guns, cars, automobiles, kick doors in, flash bangs, and the whole work. But the problem was, I was one of the inspectors that, you know, put in a upper level position. And I noticed when we were setting these things up, a lot of the targeted areas were urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, name an area, for example, in your where you are that would be more affluent, say white, upper class affluent. Name an area.
Riverdale.
Okay, Riverdale. Do you think they got drugs in Riverdale?
Oh, yeah, but they're such rich people, like the Kissingers live up here.
I just want to know, do you think they have drugs in Riverdale?
Yeah.
All I want to know, do you think they use drugs in Riverdale?
I think they do.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course they do. Of course, matter of fact, according to the National Crime Control statistics, in a lot of these affluent areas around the country, these white and affluent areas, they use way more drugs in those areas than they are in the urban areas. And you got the better stuff and the pure stuff and everything else. But I begin to notice that most of our targeted operations were areas of, urban areas where black and brown people were. So one day I raised the issue. Huh?
Well, look at Lindsay, the Lindsay chick.
Lindsay Lohan, right.
How many times how many times have they arrested her and they keep saying that she doesn't need to go to jail because it's overcrowded? But if it was a black person, they'd go overcrowded or not?
That wouldn't matter. Wouldn't matter. And this is the bigotry. This is the hypocrisy of America, the criminal justice system. Once you begin to see, the problem is I've talked to many black and white managers and folks in the upper levels and upper echelons, and they all agree. They will tell you, oh, yeah, man, this thing is very biased. I mean, even white folks will tell you that. The prosecutors, everybody. But you know what? It's like slavery. How did slavery last for hundreds of years? Because people who knew it was wrong just went along with the program because it wasn't affecting them and their kids. And that's what we see in America. And that's what irritates you when you deal with other black officers and people, because before you know it, they start thinking the same way. And we're going right back to that word we used right in the very beginning. What happens when you go against that blue wall of silence? What happens to you?
I want to bring up at least some of your credentials so that the listeners know your background and your training, that you were trained. You had FBI training, SWAT training. You're proficient at firearms and anti-terrorist weapons. And you've been involved, as you said, with the DEA, interrogation, forensic science, scuba diving, rescue. You're a certified paratrooper, had explosive device training, defensive and offense, hand-to-hand combat. I mean, my goodness, I guess is that the way, why they gave you the name Batman?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, pretty much that was my SWAT team training, but Batman came about was because of all the arrests we were making, and we were doing a lot of midnight and early morning raids, and jumping out on people. And one day we jumped out on this guy, and I always remember it was up on an area up in Washington, D.C., up on 14th Street Northwest. And I got there to the scene, like, my guys already made their arrest, so police was out there, you know, the lights flashing, and, you know, something you see right on. Bad boys, what you going to do, you know, cops or something, and lights on it. So I come up in my, you know, undercover car, and I got my little blue light on. And I come up, and I get out the car, and I'm undercover. You know, I got my regular clothes, and I got my badge hanging on me. And you know, and I go in, I walk up to the guy, and the guy's leaning against the car, handcuffed on. I said, hey, man, how you doing? And I walked up to him, and I said his name. And he looked around at me, and he said, who the hell are you, right?
Mm-hmm.
In front of everybody. So I just kind of jokingly, I said, I'm Batman. And with that voice, you know, deep, I'm Batman, you know. And when I said it, to be honest with you, at that moment, I felt like I had a cape on. Yeah, I really did. It was like, I don't know how to explain it to you. And he looked at me, he said, Batman? Then he just kind of looked, Batman. He looked around at everybody. And so then everybody heard him say it. And then later, when we were driving down to the station to interrogate him because of the reference to a big drug deal, we were trying to get him to help us out on some drugs. But he said, he saw a lamp and he was sitting in the seat. He said, Marshall, he said, I got to give it to you, man. He said, man, the way you said that, you really look like that, man. He just was laughing to himself. And from that point on, people started. That's how we became Batman and Batgroup. And when I left the group, they gave me this nice plaque with Batman on it with a cape, you know, flying the real actual emblem of Batman. And the plaque talks about, and it says on the plaque, it talks about us making over 300 of America's most wanted arrests and the Metropolitan Area Task Force Supervisory Inspector Matthew Fogg, a.k.a. Batman, and says, we will miss you. You know, and so that's pretty much how that whole thing of Batman came about with me.
Well, see, now those are some of the good moments, but I want to ask you or mention that the Department of Justice is actually over two centuries old.
The Department of Justice?
The Department of Justice, the United States Marshal Service, I know it's an elite agency it spans about two centuries.
That's
but
great.
How
That's
recently great. Would you say the doors have been opened to recruits of color? Because primarily before it was mostly whites and mostly male.
Well, the Marshal Service, when you look at it, it started in 1789. Of course, back then, it was prejudice existed in the country. I mean, segregation, racism, all that. But there were black marshals back then. And Frederick Douglass, Frederick Douglass was the first black U.S. marshal.
Oh, really?
And a lot of people. Yeah, Frederick Douglass was the first black U.S. marshal. And, when you look at discrimination. Well, let me do this. Before we go to this part, I want to, because I didn't finish the story, I want to tell you something about what happened with this Dragnet thing and what brought race into play. Because I brought up the issue of why were we targeting these urban areas and why weren't we going out to Riverdale and to Potomac and to all of the affluent places in these areas, these cities and these locations we were going in to do these Dragnet. Because we knew, DEA, we knew who were buying the drugs. We knew where the drugs were in the white affluent areas. But I had a special agent in charge. He pulled me off to the side. And he said, Paul, look here, man. He said, because I was raising the issue. Look, man, this thing is an equal employment opportunity enforcement operation. How come we not going after everybody? Why are we just sticking to the urban areas? And you know what he said? He said, look, man. He said, you're right. He said, they use probably more drugs out in those areas. And we know it. He said, but if we go out there and start locking those folks up, he said, ain't no lawyers, ain't no congressmen, ain't no judges, ain't no chiefs of police. He said, you go start locking them people up. He said, man, let me tell you something. We're going to get a phone call, and they're going to shut our operation down. He said, and you know what? There goes your overtime. There goes your seizures. There goes everything, all the fun you have, everything you're doing. There goes your operation. In other words, and he said, man, just go after the weakest links. Don't worry about it, man. We're doing a good job. We convinced in America that we won on drugs. And when it's all over, we'll have big press conferences, show all the drugs we confiscated and all of that. But the bottom line was, it was, in so many words, it was ethnic cleansing.
Nice.
And it turned out to be why today when you see 80% of the drug arrests are people of color. It's crazy,
well, especially
man.
If you know the drugs are coming from the wealthy, that they're the ones that can afford to bring it in the country.
That's right. Supply and demand. They're the ones who want it. They're the ones who, and they're going to get it. And you're not going to cut it off by us going, unless those congressmen and people like that are willing for us to go lock up their nephews and nieces and their people, which they're not. And that's what I said about slavery. That's the reason why I said slavery lasts. Slavery lasts. If we called ourselves a Christian nation and we get on every other nation about not human rights, not doing it right. And you know me, I was on the board of directors with Amnesty International, the world's largest human rights organization. And So I understand human rights issues. And we go around the world and this country try to police everybody else, and we have some of the worst human rights history violations in the world. We talk about slavery. Slavery, there's nothing you can compare with slavery when you talk about a child being ripped away from you and sold, and you having no right over that child. I think anybody in America that has a child or a daughter, some kid that they love, would understand when somebody's taken from them.
Of course.
That's what slaves, that's what black women and men had to endure for hundreds of years in a country that called itself a Christian nation. It was about the most hypocritical thing you could ever come to say.
Huh? We know that. That's pure hypocrisy.
But I'm just saying, right, and so you think about the same thing with the war on drugs. We started doing the exact same thing. It's like the nature of this thing never changes. It continues. It just mutates into something else. If it's not the war on drugs and we finally regulate and stop this craziness, then what else will this racist, sort of mantra, this historical thing, what else will it mutate into? It's always mutating into something.
All people of color, whether they're Hispanic, Asian, or black?
Say what now?
Are this discrimination, is it against all the peoples of color, whether Hispanic, black, or Asian, Native Americans?
Well, I mean, let's put it this way. African Americans, at least from the criminal justice perspective, seem to have been the targets more. Now, I'm just saying brown people, Hispanics, begin to be targets and Asians, but black, what we call Afro-Americans, they were the biggest targets. And they were the ones who were enslaved. You know, Hispanics, wasn't a big epidemic of Hispanics being enslaved. It was people brought from Africa that was enslaved. And that historical tradition moved on, even though we said it's no more what we call slavery. It's still a problem in America, even when you look at how they treat the president. I mean, you even look at that level. I think every black and white, everybody sees it and has seen it. People try to pretend like it ain't there, try to ignore it. And anytime you mention race, they go, oh, that's playing the race card. That's one of the most disturbing things I can hear somebody tell about playing a race card. America is a race card.
They always use that offense, defense tactic to keep you silent. But now I want to take a break, and I'm going to come back, and we're going to talk about your lawsuit. We're going to get into the court now. So just hang out there. Go get a cup of tea, and we shall return.
All righty.
We are back, and we are talking to Matthew Falk. This is the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. I'm Deirdre Shuler, your host, and this is Topically Yours. Now, what prompted you? All these things happened. A question I wanted to ask you, too, is how do you feel when you're out in the field and you have your white officers backing you up? Do you feel protected by them, or do you worry? Or did you worry, I should say?
Well, one of the things I felt like when I was in the field was, there were times, I mean, I was involved in an incident where my white counterparts, my white colleagues left me on a stakeout. And I have other friends who spoke out, even a white guy, a Jewish guy, Steve Zanowitz. When Steve spoke out. He was out of New York, him and another black officer, U.S. Marshal, named Bill Scott, who later was killed, died from his injuries of a car accident. And somebody drove his car beside the road. We don't know who did that, but they found it sort of suspicious, and it broke his neck. But he was involved in a discrimination lawsuit the same way that Steve Zanowitz, the white guy, was involved from taking up for the black guy. And then, of course, myself. So we were like the Mississippi Three in the Marshall Service. all three of us, our lives were, all three of our lives were put in danger and put in, we were put in harm's way. Now, that's the key when you're talking about being in law enforcement or being in the military and going against the grain, because you're going what they call against the blue, you're going against that wall of blue or that green wall of silence, and you have to depend on people to back you up. I mean, you hear all of these stories many times in the military about people being killed by what we call friendly fire.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I mean, it's very easy to happen because you all got guns and you're all trained how to use those weapons. And when bullets are flying, you know, anybody can be accidentally shot, you know. So,
and who's going to dispute it?
Hello. So, I mean, you know, and then other things can happen to me. Somebody can leave you at the wrong time and whatever. So, you know, you take all that into consideration. That's what family, friends, and people were concerned with when I decided that I was going to file a discrimination complaint early on in my career, when we had this particular white manager who was a known racist. And white and black people knew that. They knew this guy had bias, had racial issues. But the strategy was to avoid him. And he was a chief deputy U.S. Marshal. So everybody said, look, just avoid this guy. Don't, you know, just go around and fog. Don't file no complaints. Don't get into that, because once you do that, that marks your career. That, you know, and what it does is this, and I explain this to people all the time. The system works like this. You got a lot of good people, as my lawyer said that to the judge one day during the trial, because the judge is going to say, look, are you telling me this is a conspiracy? And the judge is, you know, during the trial, the judge goes, I mean, my lawyer said, yeah, it's a conspiracy. The judge would have said, dismiss. He would have threw the case out. And I always remember my lawyer's response. He said, are you telling me this is a conspiracy? Like, you know, are you telling all these people get together so they can just mess up folks? The judge says, no, I'm not saying it's a conspiracy in the sense of the legal language of a conspiracy. He said, but what you got is you got a lot of good people doing bad things. And what happens is, you know, it could be a conspiracy in the sense that if, you know, you're a manager, right? And
mm-hmm.
you're in a position and somebody's filing a complaint against you, and you've got other managers and other friends and colleagues that know you. So they get the word, oh, Matt Frog is filing a complaint against one of our friends, one of our manager buddies. Oh, okay. I know to look out for that name. So it can very easily, somebody just say, hey, that guy is not good because he filed me. Oh, really? Oh, so well, you know it, everybody's looking at you.
Right.
And you can go anywhere, and it's very easy for somebody to pick up a phone call and say, hey, you got Matt Fall coming over to you. Just be careful.
Well,
so
the stress of it, did it make you sick, or were you fearful
sure.
for your life?
Yes, obviously. And I ended up going out on workers' comp after they left me on a stakeout to get killed over in Baltimore. And we took down one of America's most wanted fugitives. After that incident, I was like, look, let me get out of here, because the white guys who were supposed to be, you know,
back
part of, and I'm the supervisory inspector in charge, so they had to come through me before they leave the scene. They ended up leaving the scene and going all the way, driving all the way back to Washington, D.C., and was sitting up in my boss's office telling them I didn't know what I was doing. I was on a wild goose chase. All this crazy stuff, and instead of him saying, well, look, does Frog know y'all here? If he doesn't, give me a memo. But instead, he had his deputy chief to call me up right before I made the arrest, and the deputy chief was telling me that the chief is upset because these guys are talking about me, and the chief is getting ready to pull the task force back from me, and I got 3 days to make the arrest. And here it is. I'm locking up a guy, two guys who their team, the white guys, they had been looking for him for over a year and couldn't find him. It took me 3 weeks to get him when they put me in charge of the task force. And the guy was an America's most wanted, a profile on TV. And the point I'm making is, after I hung up from the deputy chief, we ended up, as fate would have it, I got a phone call from one guy that was watching a particular location. He said, Fog, everything fits. They just drove up in a certain vehicle and everything. We went over there, and make a long story short, we ended up arresting these guys, and the guys, both of them were heavily armed. One of them had a pistol and trying to pull it out. I ended up We ended up taking him down with no shots fired, and everyone had a Mac 10 and a Mac 11 machine gun laying on the back seat. They had a machine gun and a bag full of handcuffs, a loaded machine gun. This was the type of arrest you want. And we took these guys off the street. And then my boss was going to tell me, just let bygones, instead of charging those guys with insubordination or leaving the scene, all he said, let bygones be bygones.
Didn't they promote them or promote one of them?
Yeah, they ended up getting promoted.
Well, what happened when you went to court? You were the jury awarded in your favor, correct?
Yeah. Now, believe it or not, that particular incident never even got in front of the jury per se. That one didn't. The incidents that got in front of the jury was non-promotion, a bunch of other stuff that I alleged. They put me in a government vehicle and tried to, that the white guy was telling you about, the chief that started all this stuff, sent me, tried to make me drive an unsafe vehicle all the way down to Glencoe, Georgia, could have got me killed. Promotions, holding up on my not processing my discrimination complaints, all this other stuff. And then ultimately, like I said, with the incident that happened over in Baltimore, I went out on workers' comp. But by the time we got to trial in 1998, we presented all of the things that I had went through in front of that jury. And that jury listened to everything. And, of course, the government tried to say, well, no. And then also, they had terminated me. They had fired me from the Marshals because they tried to order me back in. When I went out on workers' comp, they tried to order me back in for work, and I wouldn't come in. I said, I'm not coming back in until y'all get this stuff straight. And I thought they was trying to get me back in there, of course, so they could kill me. And
mm-hmm.
The bottom line was, when I didn't go back in there, then they charged me with insubordination. And then they went through with the whole process and ended up firing me. But I was out on workers' comp, so workers' comp said, well, you can't fire the man while he's on workers' comp. So we're not going to let you do that. They said, we're going to continue paying him. So technically, I was still being paid as a marshal, but the marshal was saying they had fired me. So then in 98, the jury came back, and the jury said that we find in the civil action of Matthew Favre versus the I always say the mighty U.S. Department of Justice. We find that you violated 13 out of 14 of the civil rights claims. We order you to reinstate him from an inspector to a chief deputy, GS-15 U.S. Marshal. We order you to pay all of his back pay, the difference in the salary that I think I was out at that time out of 13. They had to give me the difference in the salary, make me whole again, pay all my attorney's fees separately, and paid me the maximum. Now, what they did, they awarded me $4 million. But at that time, as it is today, which we're trying to get this law returned, there was a cap on what federal employees could get individually, $300,000. So the jury is not told that. So ultimately what happened was the jury, even though the jury thought they was giving me $4 million, they didn't know that was going to be reduced to $300,000.
Okay, and that's what you walked away with, $300,000?
Yeah. I mean, technically, but ultimately a lot more than that, because what happened was the jury in 98, what the jury found was the Marshal Service Bureau, not only was they find that they had violated these 13 claims within my interrogatory that we had in the jury form, it's 13 of them. Not only did they find that they had violated these claims of mine, but they also found two of the claims we had on there was the Marshal Service a racial hostile environment for all of its African-American deputy U.S. Marshals prior to 1991 and after 1991. And the jury checked off both, yes, racial hostile environment. So pretty much what the jury was saying was, and I tell people, I said, I talk about that in my book. I said, when I was sitting there in that courtroom, it's lonely. Because by the time you get to that level, a lot of people, all your friends have abandoned you. Nobody wants to be around you. I mean, there's a story I call Serpico. I mean, and what he went through, the ostracization. My black partner had been killed. The white guy had been ran off the job. They had fired him. you know, I was out there by myself. Anybody that stood up against the powers to be, FBI agents, DEA, ATF agents, black agents that had stood up, the powers to be, most every one of them had been fired and lost their jobs and was fighting from the outside. It was, they made it so difficult. It was like a runaway slave. You got two choices. You either get away or get killed, because if they catch you, they're going to kill you and mess you up. So, I mean, it was like that. And so when I'm sitting in that courtroom and that jury is reading that verdict and that jury is reading a landmark decision that, you know, saying all of these things and then come back and say, we find that not only that, but you will pay him $4 million. That was the highest award at that time that any federal employee had gotten on a jury award. And then on top of that, the jury said, we find the whole U.S. Marshal Service from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C., from Houston, Texas, the main to their racial hostile environment for all of its African-American deputy U.S. Marshals. So that's when the tears rolled down my face at that point in time. Because you got to realize, by the time I got to trial, I had been fighting them 13 years. It was 13 years.
Thirteen years, my God.
No, but it took a lot longer than that. That was just to get the trial, to get to a verdict. Then the government ended up appealing it for 10 more years. I didn't get paid until 2008.
Wow. So it was 23 years?
Yes. And still ongoing, because there's still some stuff they didn't pay me for, my leave and certain. And on top of that, we got a class action going, which I'm the class agent in the class action. Matthew Fogg et al. Versus the U.S. Marshal, taking all of that stuff. And now I'm standing in the gap for all them other marshals, who a lot of them were afraid and running from me, didn't want to be seen with me and everything else at the time. Now I'm standing in the gap for all of them. So it has been a journey to justice. Matter of fact, speaking of that, Johnny Cochran, he opened up a firm in D.C., and him and I got a chance to talk a lot. And he did a study on the numbers of cases that are won at the court level that I won mine, and then at the appeal level, they are overturned. So his concern was, he was like amazed that my case was not overturned, because a lot of these cases get overturned at the appellate level. And you know what he said to me? He said, Fogg, you are an anomaly, man. He said, I've never seen nobody like you. He said, man, for you to fight that long and not give in and not take their settlement offer and didn't go to the Court of Appeals and win, he said, man, you're an anomaly. And I quote him in my book.
And a brave, brave, brave soul.
Yeah.
You're
this is what it takes. And going forward, you know.
So it takes a lot of courage and fortitude to continue under all that pressure. But I'm going to take another break. And
I used to be a cop, but I got to be too jumpy. I used to like to party till I caused a path along. Sometimes late at night, I hear the beat of bumping. I reach for my holster and I wake up all alone. All the time. Sometimes late at night, I circle around the house. I look through the
And we are back. This is the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Soul, and we're talking to Matthew Falk and Mr. Falk. So what are you doing these days?
Well, today I'm what a retired U.S. Marshal. I'm a retired Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal. Today I still represent individuals, do a lot of volunteer work helping individuals around the country file discrimination complaints. I've become an expert in the business. I've won 7 up to 8 cases now before the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission representing individuals. You can represent people and not be a lawyer at the administrative level, but you have to know all of the rules like lawyers know. So I've been gotten really good at it due to my interrogation techniques and everything, getting these folks on the stand to say the right things, you know, when they try to lie and all of the rest of that. I also, I'm the national vice president for an all women's organization called Federally Employed Women. That's few.org on the network, www.few.org. And my profile is up there. These women made me their national vice president for congressional relations, which is a powerful thing because it says a lot about the fact that I stand in the gap for a lot of women who have stood up for their rights. As well as I'm the national vice president, I just got elected the national first vice president for blacks in government. That's www.bignet.org on the web. And I will start that duty in January as the national first vice president for blacks in government. And again, you know, these things, as well as the government finally gave me some money, a substantial amount, matter of fact, in 2008, because for the interest of running 10 years, the back pay and all that, they still wind up getting me in the $1 million category. So it was God, to God be the glory, you know, things happen.
You certainly deserve it after all of that.
Right. And so I'm trying to work on this book, and also I'm hoping we can get a movie out of this thing. So God is going, you know, he's blessed me and anointed me to go forward. And I just, these are the things that I'm doing now and working with other organizations who are human rights organizations, civil rights organizations, trying to do the right thing.
But do you have a website that people can check you out as well?
Right now, my website is bigotswithbadges.com, but I that's got to be updated. But bigots, because that's going to be the name of the book, Bigots with Badges.
Bigotswithbadges.com.
Yeah, bigotswithbadges.com. They can also go up on GovLink. Actually, they can email me at my name, Matthew, with 2 T's, .fogg, F-O-G-G, at Leap. That's Leap, L-E-A-P, like leapfrog, Leap, L-E-A-P, .cc. So that's Matthew.fogg at leap.cc. And I'm working on leap.charlie.cc.
CC, okay.
And they can email me. I'm on LinkedIn on the network, LinkedIn. I'm also, I had a page up on Facebook, but somebody keeps going in and keeps going in and taking me down off of Facebook. I don't know if people hack in somehow and change it around and I can't get into it. So that's been a problem for me with Facebook. And pretty much, GovLoop, I've got a couple of websites up there on GovLoop. If they just Google me, a whole lot of stuff pops up. But I'll send links out if people want more information on a couple of videos out there. News, CBS did a story on me. Channel 7 did a story on me. So there's news stuff out there that validates everything that I'm saying, you know.
I know you were featured in the New York Post and the Washington Post as well, right, and C-SPAN?
Yeah, C-SPAN. And then, like I said, WMAL, I got a video, a 7-minute video that I show to a lot of my audiences. And it's pretty good. It's a comprehensive story. It talks about what happened. Matter of fact, I'll send it to you, Deirdre, if you want.
Yes,
and,
I'd love to.
You know, just email me and remind me. I'll send those links over to you.
What was your email again? Did you give me your email on LinkedIn?
I thought I did, but anyways, what I just gave, Matthew.fogg, my name with 2 T's, .fogg, at leap at leap.cc.
Oh, okay. That's your email. All right.
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, you know, we have reached the end of our time. It went fast, correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's actually, I did more talking on this one normally than I normally do. Normally, people have more music comes in and more breaks. Yours, man, she's letting me just talk on.
Well, yeah, that's the point. The point is to get
right.
Your story.
Right.
So that's what I do, and now I know about your book, your life, your court case, and all the things that you're doing, which are very admirable. And I want to thank you for being my guest today, Matthew Falk.
Thank you. And so be sure to contact me, okay?
I certainly
will. And I'll
know
if I give you my, you have my number.
I
don't want to put it on the air.
No, I have it. I see it.
Okay, great.
And I'll email you with mine later.
Okay.
So thank you again for coming on the show and for being the creative, courageous person that you've been and giving dignity through human rights. And I encourage you to continue the fight. And this is This is the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Soul. I want to thank my audience for making my topically yours. And now we're going to end the show with that famous song that we all love, Beverly Hills Cop.
You've been listening to the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul.